Hello.
And welcome to the Natural Selection Presents Organs. Welcome back, listeners, to the Natural Selection Presents. This week, we're dealing with organs. We were once a class, maybe a family, and in no particular order, it's hello from Nick.
Hello.
Hello from Naomi.
Hello.
And hello from the other Nick. Hello. Naomi, will you introduce our new listeners to the theme and structure of our podcast?
Yeah, of course. So we are Natural Selection. We're taxonomists, and we want to bring our passion for nature out into the wild. Each week, we meet up, and in the first section, we talk about news and research that has come up in the last couple of weeks. And in the second part, we discuss a different theme, and we talk about different animals and plants in the natural world under that theme. This week, our theme is organs.
Well, I'm organizing my thoughts to get talking about organs today. It's the best I could do on short notice. So let's do a little check-in. How are you guys' weeks? See any cool nature, Nick?
Yeah, I had two instances of being shocked by nature this week. One was in my German language class, where I was happily learning German, and I looked down at my book to find a rather sizable true bug.
It was
over a centimeter long, and it was sort of like, I think it was like a brown shield bug. I wasn't too sure because I was so shocked that I, after staring at it for a good few seconds, I then realized that my teacher was saying my name on Zoom, and I was just staring into space, it looked like. So I picked up the bug on my pencil and showed the class, which is not the question she had asked me. I think it was something about German rather than, can you show me a bug? I then explained I had to go and let it out the window. I was genuinely shocked by that bug. The other genuinely shocked thing is these tiny birds. I threatened to look up what they are in Berlin many times on this show, and I never have. And I never will. I'm going to say it now. Never will. But they were in a tree, and one was chasing the other, and they both dive-bombed, and one was clearly following the other. I don't know why. I didn't ask. But it was clearly following, and the lead one went really, really close to the floor. And when it was literally about 10, 15 centimetres from striking the floor, and this is quite a rapid pace, like it's falling, it then swept along the floor as fast as it could to get away, and the other one followed it. And I was sort of amazed by this. It reminded me of sort of like a dog fight in the air. But yeah, it's clearly a manoeuvre to try and outwit the other one, but it didn't work. But I was sort of amazed by their swiftness, if you will. But they're not swifts.
Great, Nick. I have two great stories. One where you really demonstrate your love of beetles and for taxonomy, and the other where you have openly admitted to not caring. No, it's very...
I have to say, you can say that, but you clearly don't care about insects, because I mentioned they were true bugs and that it was a shield bug, and you immediately like, oh, beetles, whatever, they're all the same, aren't they?
Beetles. It's true. I'm not an entomologist.
This is what I have to compete with, audience. They just dismiss this entire group of animals.
It's true. Well, anyway, back to the big real animals. Naomi, what have you seen?
I haven't seen that much nature this week. The weather has been improving, so I'm tending to avoid the busy, peoply areas which have the nature in them and going for more houses and kind of suburban areas. So my nature interaction, actually, so I was given a bouquet of flowers, and I've decided to press some of the flowers. So I think they're daisies that I'm pressing. So kind of nature that I'm trying to bring into my home. But, yeah.
I think that also demonstrates our collective lack of knowledge about plants. I think they're daisies.
I tried Googling it, I'll be honest, but I think Asteraceae are one of those ones that even people who study them have a hard time dividing them out, and also it's from a florist, so it's probably, you might be not a natural occurring species.
There's two paths we can go down. We could either call on one of our past members, who is an Asteraceae specialist, or we could just go the route of the backyard naturalist and say they're one of those DYCs, the damn yellow composite. I haven't seen any good nature out and about, just a lot of, you know, the urban birds, which are nice, they're nice. But I will say that during the course of our conversation over the last 5 minutes, my roommate's cat has jumped up on my desk and methodically tried to eat everything smaller than her head that's on my desk right now. And I've had to sort of shuffle everything around, and right now she's eating my pen. So that's my animal interaction for the week. I have a wild tiger on my desk in miniature. I think that brings us to the end of our check-in. It's nice to always hear what you guys are seeing, and sort of, I think maybe over the course of the year, one can get a sense of how often we go outside. So let's talk about the news. I'll start today, and I want to talk about dinosaurs. Yeah, not necessarily one of my preferred topics, but something that I'm, you know, casually interested in. And this week's research was super cool. I'm really excited to share this one with you guys. So the paper that I was looking at was studying community structure and diversity in dinosaur communities. And the three researchers, they're all American, Caitlin Schroeder, Kathleen Lyons, and Felisa Smith, looked at 43 dinosaur communities across 136 million years in 7 continents. And what they were looking for is they were trying to understand something strange about the dinosaur record, which is that when you look at modern communities of carnivores, you see carnivores in most communities with small bodies, medium bodies, and large bodies. Think mongoose, hyena, lion. Within one community, you can have those three different sized of bodies, and they eat different things, and they sort of fill different ecological niches. It's common to see that, the small, medium, large. In some dinosaur communities, there's no medium level. There's small dinosaurs, and there's giant dinosaurs, and there's nothing in the middle. And it seemed like there was sort of this gap, like it's a pattern we see really often, and it seems strange. And what they were trying to figure out was this size variation. It reflects available prey sources. These communities have small, medium, and large-bodied herbivores. So what's going on here? And what they found out was that communities with megatheropods, these are the dinosaurs that are over like 1,000 kilograms, something like Tyrannosaurus rex is a good example. These are the communities specifically that didn't have the mid-level. So when they had really big things, they didn't have medium-sized things. And their hypothesis was that juvenile megatheropods ate what normally medium-sized carnivores would eat in the community. When dinosaurs are born, they're born very small. The eggs are quite small compared to the end body size. So the growing dinosaur has to go through the stage from small body all the way up to enormous giant body. They don't start giant. So they eat different things when they're young than their adults, their parents do. So the things that they're eating when they're juveniles and can hunt for themselves are the things that normally would be eaten by a mid-sized carnivore in a modern community. So their hypothesis was that basically the smaller body, the difference in prey sources that the smaller body juveniles and the larger bodies adults sort of fills up both of those niches within one species with this group of megatheropods. So the effect of this is that the community structure overall has a reduced trophic diversity and less species diversity in the communities with megatheropods, which is a bizarre sort of community dynamic to keep in mind when we think about dinosaur communities. So by having this huge range of body size within one species, they eliminate the ability for other species, mid-sized carnivores, to exist in that community. Thought it was a cool, like, thing to learn about the past and also to think about how large-bodied animals exist now and why they're allowed, why we can have large-bodied animals and mid-sized carnivores. Nick, you have something a little bit grimmer for us, but also deal with big-bodied animals.
Yeah, I'm here to talk about polar bears. One of the most popular animals, I think at least in cuddly toys. They are famously adorable and popular in zoos, but their environment is shrinking because of man-made global warming. These researchers from the University of California in Santa Cruz, what they did is they compiled a load of other studies about polar bears to see what information they could gain and some insights into their lives because of that. It was in the Journal of Experimental Biology this week, and basically what they found is that polar bears are using 3 times as much energy now as they would otherwise need to if the ice wasn't shrinking. And they were looking as to why that could be. And obviously this is causing big problems because the more energy you have to use, the more food you would have to use, and this is going to affect the ecosystem, but it makes it much less likely for a polar bear to be able to survive without starving to death. They also looked at narwhals and how it would affect them as well because they hunt using ice. And narwhals are also affected by, say, like human shipping traffic as well. Interestingly, polar bears are endangered, but narwhals, there's over 100,000 narwhals worldwide, so they are listed as least concern, but polar bears are very much on the brink. And part of the problem is, yeah, this lack of ice as the world warms. Since 1979, ice has shrunk by 13% every decade. So it's continuously shrinking, and I think last September was the lowest recorded ice levels we have, which means it's difficult for them to hunt, because bears walk very well, and they can run for short distances. But what polar bears are not good at is swimming. And swimming actually uses three times as much energy for them as walking would. And there's some amazing statistics coming out of this. So one female they found in these studies, she'd swum 287 miles in 10 days in the Beaufort Sea, seemingly with little to no rest. They also found that it's not just any type of swimming which can cause problems, because now they're having to hunt underwater. And this type of swimming as well uses three times as much energy as idly swimming. So their hunting is using more energy, their traveling between hunting grounds is using more energy, and as a result they estimate that, yeah, polar bears are now using three times as much energy as they previously were to survive.
That is grim news, Nick. That doesn't bode well. It seems like polar bears as apex predators are always going to be sort of struggling for enough resources, because what they need requires so much from the ecosystem. But even, I mean, now it seems doesn't look good.
No, and the other thing I glean from this is that because the ice is shrinking as well, it's actually increasing the range of things like killer whales, which might eat things that the polar bears want to, because they're not obstructed by the ice, so they can start hunting the food that the polar bears otherwise would.
We like to sandwich our bad news on this podcast. So we have luckily an upswing here. Not all species are hurtling towards extinction. Some of them are hurtling right back.
Yeah, so my piece of news was very exciting this week. A bird has been rediscovered after 160 years without any discoveries of it. So the bird in question is the black-browed babbler. So in the 1840s, this bird was caught on an expedition in the East Indies, and it was described and named the black-browed babbler, or its scientific name is Malacuncilla presspicillata. And at the moment, this is classed as data deficient on the IUCN Red List. This is the only bird that has been captured. They only have this one specimen of it, and it hasn't really been spotted again or described by science. And part of the problem was this type specimen was never really linked to a location. So they didn't really know where they should be looking for this species again. But late last year, two men from Indonesia in Borneo saw this bird that they didn't recognize. So they captured it and they took a photograph of it before they released it. And then they sent it to the local birding organizations. So a short description has been published in Birding Asia, but the official publication of it is still yet to be released. But there's a write-up on it in The Guardian and also on RTE News. And I'll just give you the description that it gives in the Birding Asia article. It says, the bird has a stout appearance with a relatively short tail and a robust bill consistent with the hollowed type. The upper parts are a rich brown, while the underparts of the bird are kind of grayish with fine white streakings. The facial appearance of the bird is very distinct, with the crown being chestnut brown, demarcated by a broad black eye stripe extending across the malars to the nape and the neck sides. The irides were deep red, which is different to the holotype, which were given artificially yellow eyes, and the legs are dark slate grey. So yeah, that's this bird that hasn't been seen in 160 years, which is great because they now know where it is, so they know that this is an area that they need to help preserve and maybe try and research a little bit more about these birds.
Brilliant. Bird brought back. Black-browed babbler rediscovered.
Yes. Very good.
Well, I think that brings us to the end of our news section of today's podcast. We will take a quick break and join you again soon where we talk about organs. Welcome back, everyone. That was a shorter absence than the black-browed babbler had. We're glad to have you back. So we're going to start our topic off by talking about organs this week. And Naomi, I think you wanted to bring us to the heart of the matter.
I was going to use that pun, but yeah.
Have you got any other puns in the chamber?
We could just go with the flow.
So I decided that I wanted to talk about hearts this week. And I had a couple of different facts about different animal hearts and different circulatory systems, so I'll just get straight into it. So there's roughly divided two different types of circulatory systems. There's an open circulatory system where basically the organs are surrounded by blood and the oxygen is supplied through this method. The blood tends to flow slowly because there's no smooth muscle, which is responsible for contracting the blood vessels. So this is a system that you might find in a lot of invertebrates, crabs, insects, snails, that sort of animal. The other type is a closed circulatory system. So the blood is kept to the blood vessels. It doesn't leave the blood vessels. And this is how the oxygen and deoxygenating the blood is carried around the system. With the closed circulatory system, it can either be a single circulatory system or a double circulatory system. So with a double circulatory system, you would find a four-chambered heart, like what we have. And so do other mammals and birds as well. Frogs have three chambers. And so they have two atria and one ventricle. The oxygenated blood is kept separate from the deoxygenated blood because there's special grooves in the ventricle called trabeculae that keep the oxygenated blood separate. So have you guys ever heard that a blue whale's heart is the size of a small car?
I have heard that.
So interestingly enough, in 2015, a team from Canada dissected a heart and they found that actually it's not quite that big. Probably a little bit closer to the size of a small golf cart.
Okay, and that's still quite big.
It's still very big, yeah. So it's the biggest heart of any animal on the planet. It weighs 400 pounds or 181 kilograms, which is three of me. Interestingly, something else I found is they are able to slow their heart rate really dramatically when they dive. They're able to get it as low as 2 to 8 beats per minute. And then when they go back up to the surface, they get it up to about 25 to 37 beats a minute. The animal that has the fastest heart rate that I could find, I think it's the mammal with the fastest heart rate, is the Etruscan shrew. If you haven't seen any pictures of this, it's worth a Google because it's teeny tiny. And its heart beats 1,500 beats per minute, which is pretty incredible. So in terms of size as well, the animal that I could find that had the largest heart-to-body ratio was the dog. So it's about 0.8% of a ratio.
Oh, dogs have big hearts.
I know, I thought that was really sweet. It makes so much sense.
That's so good.
Something else I found, so originally when people were looking at giraffes, they thought the giraffes also had really big hearts, but they don't have that big a heart. But what they do have is they have a really thick wall of their heart. They're able to pump a lot of blood, put a lot of force behind it. So they have really high blood pressure, 280 over 180. Another interesting thing I found about some other animals, cephalopods, so octopus, squid, and cuttlefish, they have three hearts. And some animals actually don't have hearts at all. So starfish, sea cucumbers, and coral, jellyfish also don't have hearts. Jellyfish seem to be the largest animal that doesn't have a heart. Earthworms also have pseudo hearts. So they don't pump blood, but they squeeze the blood vessels to help circulate the blood. And my last fact, zebrafish can regrow their heart. From about 20% damage, they're able to regrow their heart.
That's, my heart is full with all that heart information, Naomi. Thank you.
Yeah, I feel like we've all had our heart damaged about 20%, so that would be good.
Maybe a heart isn't essential to living if some of these animals don't have them, but what about brains?
Yeah, this week I'm very much the scarecrow to Naomi's Tin Man. You might be interested to know that scientists have another theory on what our brains are for. Because we often talk about things like artificial intelligence, and you read things about computers like Deep Blue beating the world's best chess players, and then even things like winning at Jeopardy, an American quiz show, and even playing games like Go, which is meant to be infinitely more complicated than chess. Go computers have finally beaten human Go players, which was thought to be this next big milestone in artificial intelligence and creating sort of the computer brain. But what if sort of intelligence and problem solving isn't what our brain is for? Are you guys familiar with tunicates?
They're like little pumps. That's all I know. Sea pumps.
Yes, yeah. Are they sea squirts? Is that also something that they're called?
They are. They're quite amazing little animals. And what's especially amazing about them is they have a brain for half their life cycle. And this can give a wonderful insight about what our brain is actually for. Their first stage of their life cycle, when they're swimming about the ocean, they have a brain and they look like a tadpole and they're swimming about trying to find a place to live. They then latch onto a rock or a surface And they start to grow into their second form, the Tunicate, looking like a pump. And they devour their brain, basically because it will give them extra energy. But they don't need it anymore because they're not moving. This is scientists' theory on why the brain evolved was not necessarily for problem solving and things like that or making decisions, but merely to move. It's a way for things to move about and be motile. You notice that plants don't have brains and they don't really move in the same way. And this is very true because if you've ever seen robots, sometimes on the telly, they're inevitably Japanese, where they try and walk or do complicated movement.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Like, I'm sure it's really difficult to do, and I'm amazingly impressed with all the scientists doing it. But you got to admit, generally pretty rubbish, isn't it?
It looks pretty silly.
Yeah, and any four-year-old human is probably more competent at moving and climbing and swimming and doing all these different things than a robot. And these robots are generally only to do one thing. So a climbing robot generally can't walk upstairs. A swimming robot probably couldn't run. So programming movement is exceptionally difficult. You need an incredibly complicated computer to do that. And it just so happens we're walking around with one. So all those people there wondering, you know, well, am I doing enough with my brain? Is my brain being active enough? If it's keeping anything moving in your body, then it's doing its job rather well. So be proud.
Earlier, Nick, when you were talking about the Tunicate, I thought, it's kind of like when you get home from a long day, just want to plop down on the couch, turn on the telly, consume your brain for nutrients. You know, Tunicates having half a brain for only half their life, it feels like, yeah, when you don't need it anymore, you don't need it.
Feels like boomers, am I right, lads?
Yeah, done with school, drop that. Your head gets smart, but your brain gets dumb. No, that's the other way around. No, that's what happens. Your head gets smart, but your brain gets dumb.
What song is that?
Hey Now, You're an All-Star. Song lyrics and anxiety. So the brain is important, is what I'm picking up, Nick. But the brain is also a nexus. It's a hub for a lot of other organs. And not all of them, but many of the sensory organs are sort of like inputs for the brain. And I want to talk about one today that, I don't know, maybe you guys have heard of it. And it's not one that we learn about. It's not one of the five senses in school, but it's the vomeronasal organ, otherwise known as the Jacobson's organ. This is found in all snakes and lizards and in many mammals. It's located directly above the roof of the mouth, and it's connected via a duct, which in most mammals that have it exits just behind the front teeth, except in horses, which have something different. But that's for the expert version of our podcast, and we're not going to go into why today. The horses have something different. But so it's located in these animals. It was first discovered by the famous Dutch anatomist, whose name I can't pronounce, Ruysch, maybe, in the late 1700s, who was well known for his anatomical dissections and comparative anatomy. He was sort of like one of the first comparative anatomists who really looked at things carefully. And he was like, what is this doing here? And it seems that it works in many ways like the olfactory bulb. So it's doing similar things that our nose is doing, but it works slightly differently. So the olfactory bulb sends neuronal signals to the olfactory cortex based on volatile organic compounds in the air. So the olfactory bulb picks up volatile, i.e. evaporated compounds in the air that like pass through it. And somehow, and this is, I think we mentioned this many, many episodes ago, but it's not quite clear how scent really works. But that's not the point of today. We're talking today about the vomeronasal organ, which sends its neuronal signals not to the olfactory cortex, but to the accessory olfactory bulb, which then immediately sends it to the amygdala and ultimately the hypothalamus. And the hypothalamus it's a major neuroendocrine center, and it affects aspects of reproductive physiology and behavior, as well as other functions like body temperature, which can explain sort of, it gets us closer to understanding what the vomeronasal organ really does. And unlike the nose, the vomeronasal organ has to actually touch the compound to it in order to sense it. It doesn't work with the volatile compounds like the olfactory system does. So this has to do with, as far as I understand, big compounds in the air, and they're often very specific compounds. They're usually what we think of as pheromones, or a certain type of organic compound that's found in urine and other bodily excretions. So this vomero nasal organ is especially sensitive to within species compounds. So it's useful for detecting pheromones and things in urine and things that sort of give them an understanding of the other animals of their same species in their environment. That's the key to the vomero nasal organ and why it connects to the hypothalamus, where reproductive physiology and behavior are affected. So this can explain things like how scents and pheromones influence aggression in animals or mating behavior. But something that I think we can't really talk about the vomero nasal organ without talking about the Fleeman response. Have you guys heard of the Fleeman response? It's particular, I think, to mammal behavior, and it's found mostly in ungulates, the hoofed animals, and in cats, most felines. It's a specific physiological muscular response to an interesting or strong scent where the animal pulls back its upper lips. It's also found in some monkeys and primates, but it's most commonly seen in cats and in ungulates. And sometimes if your cat finds something that it smells sort of unusual, what it'll do is open its mouth and like breathe with its mouth open and its lips pulled back. It will like stay there and smell and breathe. I don't know if you've ever seen cats do this, but it's super bizarre. But what they're doing is they're passing air not through their nose, but through their mouth and behind the teeth, front teeth, there's a duct that leads to the vomeronasal organ. And this passes the air to the vomeronasal organ and allows the compounds in the air to reach the vomeronasal organ, where they can be detected via these neuronal impulses to the amygdala and then the brain. In snakes and lizards, I said that this is in all snakes and lizards as well, and the way that they get these compounds to touch the vomeronasal organ is by tongue flicking. That's why we see snakes flick the air with their tongues. They're not smelling the air in the way that we think of olfactory systems working, but they're using the vomeronasal organ to pick up these compounds and getting them in there with their tongue. I was looking, doing some research about this and thinking, wow, it's cool that they're in some mammals. I didn't know. And I wonder if, no, we don't have them. I would know about it. You know, we'd learn about it in school or something, or it would be the sixth sense or something. And well, I did some research and it seems like we don't actually know whether we have one or not. The research is pretty split. There are some people who say that some proportion of human population has vomeronasal organs or evidence of some sort of vomeronasal structure, organic structure in the nasal cavity. And some research that says, no, there isn't any. And I don't know. I think that's really interesting that there's a part of human anatomy, an organ, that we're not sure whether we have. And if we do have it, I wonder how effective or functional it is. So that's things to think about for the future anatomists.
So if someone asked me why I smell so terrible, I could just say, well, I might not have a vomeronasal organ.
Nick, that is one thing that you could say, and I think that would definitely make them say, oh, carry on then. So yeah, go ahead and use that one. That's good. Yeah. Or take a shower. I don't know. Up to you. Now, the vomeronasal organ, it's a sensory organ with a cool name. Luckily for us, our theme today is organs. And there are a lot of sensory organs with cool names.
Yeah. I wanted to talk about the ampullae of Lorenzini.
So I knew you'd pull through.
Thank you. And so this is a sensory organ, as Nick mentioned. So I want to go through a little bit about of the discovery of it and what it actually does. So it was named after the 17th century anatomist who discovered it, Stefano Lorenzini. This is a sense organ that sharks and elasmobranchs have. So this is sharks and rays and their relatives. So when he first discovered it, he found there was pores concentrated around the shark's mouth. And he found that when he peeled back the skin, it opened to long transparent tubes that were filled with gel. He didn't really know the function. But in the 19th century, as microscopy improved, they found that each tube ended with a bulbous pouch or an ampulla, and that there was a thin nerve came from this ampulla, and these nerves connected to the brain. And they're able to figure out from where this connected that it had the characteristic of a sensory organ. So it was characteristic of sending sensory information to the brain. But they didn't know what stimulus it was sensing. So various different research went ahead and different experiments happened during the 20th century. And in the early 1960s, they found that the ampullae of Lorenzini are sensitive to slight salinity variations and weak electric fields. So this researcher, Murray, was able to discover that the organ could respond to feel as weak as 1/1000th of a volt across a centimeter of seawater. And actually, later measurements have been able to look at brain response. Sharks seem to be able to discern 15/1000000000th of a volt. So a really weak electric field they're able to sense. So the next step of this is, why are they able to detect electric fields? Why is this useful? So around the same time, they were looking at bioelectricity in other fish, which is the emission of electric fields. So other fish, like the electric eel, emit electricity to stun or shock other fish and their prey. Other fish, however, don't have a strong enough electric field for this. It's very weak. So they realized that they were using the electric field to be able to sense their surroundings. So they use it in a sort of a radar-like way. They have receptors that are able to sense their own electric field emissions. So they were looking into this for sharks, but however, sharks and rays lack this dedicated organ for emitting electric fields. So they were able to work out that the ampullae of Lorenzi is just for detecting weak electric fields that are produced naturally in the environment. So the reason this works is, and I want to quote directly from where I found this because otherwise I'm not going to do it correctly, but the detection ability makes sense because all biological cells in the body function as batteries as a consequence of their structure. So a typical battery produces a volt when two salt solutions with different net electric charges are separated inside an electrochemical cell. Opposite charges attract, and the resulting movement of charge creates an electric current. Likewise, living cells contain a salt solution that differs from seawater, causing a voltage to arise at the interface. So basically, a fish's body in seawater operates as a weak battery, and this emits an electrical field. So I wanted to just go into experiments looking at how they figured out that sharks use this to detect their prey. So in the 1970s, Andrianus Kaminj, I'm definitely not saying that right now, I apologize, discovered that the animal bodies produce these electrical fields. And he did a series of experiments to show that the sharks use their electromagnetic sensing to hunt prey. So this was carried out on a species of shark called Scylorhinus canicula. So they introduced flounder into the area and they allowed it to bury itself in the sand. They then added liquid whiting to prompt feeding behavior in the sharks, and the shark was able to find the fish buried in the sand. What they then did was they put the flounder into the tank and they put an agar covering over it. So this was in order to block out everything except the electrical emission. So it would block out smell and other chemical emissions that flounder was emitting. The shark was able to find the fish. In order to show that it was blocking the smell, what they did was they put pieces of whiting, so and not a live fish, under this agar, and the shark didn't find it. The shark ignored it. Another thing that they did in order to show that it was the electrical field they were using to find their prey, is they put the flounder in agar and then they put an electrically insulating plastic shell over it, and it wasn't able to find the fish. Even though it was searching, it couldn't find the fish on the floor. And the final thing that they did was they buried electrodes in the bottom of this environment, and they showed that the sharks were able to locate and attack the electrodes that emitted this weak electrical fields. I think it's really cool to think about an organ or a sense that we're not able to sense and think about how other animals use this.
Reminds me of the end of one of the Jaws films where the shark attacks some electrical cables and it dies. Spoilers for whichever one that is, I can't remember.
Nick, now every time I watch this new Jaws movie, I'm going to be thinking into that one.
There's a biological reason behind why Jaws died that way. So that's good to know.
Yeah, apparently the most common cause of the transatlantic electrical cable that was the main source of transcontinental information transfer before satellites was shark bites. But Naomi, what you said at the end there about it's cool to think about, like, what is the world like for these animals that have different sensory organs than us? How does a shark understand its environment when it's getting information input about the electrical fields of the living things around it? That's really interesting to imagine. And I wanted to talk about something that does something sort of similar, but in a different, not with electrical impulses, but with the infrared. So our eyes, we see what we call visible light. But visible light is really only a very, very small portion of the electromagnetic spectrum. We think of and talk often, I think, about insects and how they can see things in the ultraviolet, which is so cool. And when you see those pictures of like flowers with their in under ultraviolet and they look like landing pads, it's like, oh, this is like, oh, yeah, they do really see things in a different way than we do. But something that I hadn't really given much thought to until this week's episode was infrared, and particularly how I've known as a fact for a long time that snakes can see infrared, with scare quotes around it, if you will. But I did some research into this and found out it's more than I thought. That seems pretty cool. And these pits, you think of, okay, pit vipers are the classic example of snakes with these infrared sensing organs, and they don't have a cool name, unfortunately. There's no ampullae of Lorenzini or the vomeronasal organ. They're just infrared sensing organs in snakes. So these pits are common in three lineages of snakes: the vipers, the boas, and the pythons. And these groups are all really far apart from each other on the snake tree. So it means that this has independently evolved three times, which is pretty cool. And the article I was reading was published in 2011, so it's not incredibly new, but it was basically saying something that still sounds true to me today, which is that we think of these pits as a sixth sense, that it adds a little bit to the sensory understanding of the environment, some sort of impression of the environment through the sensory input. But the argument that this researcher was making is that actually the pits act literally as another set of eyes. And they went through all of the different structures of these pits, talking first about the structure of the pit. So it's shaped like an aperture of a pinhole camera. And there's even in not in the boids, but in the pythons and pit vipers, a virtual lens that lets the infrared information that's coming in focus onto the sort of receptor at the base of the pit. At the back of the retina, we have a photochemical cycle that allows us to sort of light information hits the cells of the back of our retinas and it transfers information into the brain. And there's a like a photochemical cycle that happens that cascades when light hits in, then it gets like reset again. And that same thing happens in the pits, but not with chemicals, but with a capillary network of veins that act as a heat regulator. So the information then is not being transferred by chemicals, but by heat, which is why the infrared then causes the reaction rather than the much sort of higher energy, shorter wavelength of visible light. This information then is processed by the nervous system, but separately in the subsection of the brain where information from the lateral eyes, the visual, the ones that we share homologies of, the eyes of the snake, but the four images from the pits, in the case of pit vipers, which have these two sort of prominent pits on the ends of their snouts. They have the two pits and the two eyes, and the four images, the infrared and the visible light, are integrated together in the brain to produce one single image of the environment. Not so different from what our brains do when we integrate the slightly different images from our two eyes and produce one image with depth. But in the snakes, they produce one image from four with something more than depth. We'd have to call it, we don't have a word for it really with what it would be. It's a combination of infrared and visible light coming from four different points. So they have I would say, a much richer vision or sight in their environment than we do. And there's some sort of ecological influences and impacts on these pits. Arboreal snakes, the pits are directed, the sort of like sight lines of the pits are directed down from the skull, which makes sense if you're up in a tree. And for things terrestrial snakes, they're pointed up, which makes sense to look up for prey and for predators. And the last thing that I wanted to mention in this was something not in the pit vipers, pythons, or boas, but with a set of tiger snakes, which don't necessarily have these same sort of fully developed pits. So some researchers were looking at a population of tiger snakes, Notechis scutatus, in Western Australia, and they noticed this interaction between seabirds, silver gulls in particular, and these snakes, which is that the snakes would try to predate eggs. They try to eat the eggs from the nests, and the gulls would peck out the eyes of the snakes. And in this study in 1999, some researchers found that the tiger snakes that had lost their eyes had no lower body condition, growth rate, mating opportunities, or survival than the snakes that still had eyes. And their theory here was that the snakes were then sort of adapting the underdeveloped pits that they had in this lineage into full sensory organs that they could use as replacement eyes, which I think further supports the idea that these aren't just sixth sense that's sort of adding a better, like, general impression of what's happening in the environment, but are literally image-producing sensory organs, which I think is so cool. It's so cool to imagine that even in the vertebrate kingdom, there's a whole new type of eye that's developed based on heat instead of light.
Yeah, that was amazing.
We always try our best on this podcast to connect our themes from one to the next. And sometimes it's easy and sometimes it's a bit trickier. And often we go conceptual, but this time I'm going to go anatomical. And not even homologous, but just sort of roughly in the same part of the body. Pits of snakes, they're at the end of the head. And Nick, you're going to round off our topic today by talking about something else at the end of the head.
I am here to talk about sperm whales. Because they have an absolutely incredible organ called the spermaceti organ. And it's a wonderful bit of design, to be honest. And I suppose, initially I hadn't thought of it as a sensory organ, but as you guys were talking, I realised it probably does have a sensory function as well. But it also has many other functions. It's quite amazing. So, if you will, for me, imagine a sperm whale. They are almost like a square. They're very easy to draw for children. They're the largest predator on Earth, I suppose. Yeah, they actively hunt. They're the largest toothed whale. They're absolutely enormous. Yeah, I think they're like 20 to 40 tons, like absolutely massive. If you were to imagine a sperm whale, where would you think its brain might be?
Is it above its where its eyes are? Kind of in that region above its eyes?
Can I then interject and say where are its eyes?
Its eyes are quite far back in its head. It's got a really bulbous, long head, and I'm doing a lot of gesturing. This isn't useful for a podcast.
Well, to be fair, you've nailed it. That its eyes are really far back in its head, and its brain is essentially back there. It's sort of almost behind its skull in that regard. But there's a huge mass in front of its eyes, giving it that square shape. So why on earth does it have this enormous mass, which is essentially full of oil and wax? And this is called the spermaceti. And historically, it was used for things like industrial lubricant and candles and things like that. And they were heavily whaled. So hence such classics as Moby Dick. But yeah, they were hunted extensively by humans. Luckily, yeah, hunting of whales has massively declined. But why would it go to the trouble of getting all this oil and wax in its head and making it such an odd-looking whale, even compared to other giant whales? It's a strange-looking thing. Well, this organ, it turns out, has multiple uses. The other bit is that part of its head is sort of split in two diagonally, sort of creating two almost triangles. The top part is called the spermaceti. The bit below the spermaceti is called the junk. And this is actually a relic from when we were hunting it. Because what we were looking for was the spermaceti, and underneath it, the sailors called it junk. So why would they go to all this trouble of producing such this energy-dense material? So there are a few functions for it. What it is essentially it's melon, which you may recognise from things like dolphins. And the reasons dolphins have it is for things like echolocation, which they're quite famous for, their clicks. Well, sperm whales are exceptional at echolocation, and they use it to hunt. They are definitely one of the deepest diving whales. They go exceptionally deep, so there's no light down there. So how could they possibly hunt on the move? Especially for such a large animal where moving is such an expense for them. Well, they do that by echolocation. And this is how they find their prey. And they eat things like deep sea sharks, as well as things like giant squids. So they're really good at hunting. They are much, much louder than dolphins. In fact, their spermaceti can produce a noise so loud, they can use it as a weapon. It's so large that when they're getting close, they get faster and faster and faster, these clicks, so they can get an idea of where their prey is. And then it can unleash a massive noise, which potentially stun their prey, so they can catch it easier. Which is absolutely amazing. Essentially, it's using noise as a weapon that's being produced in its spermaceti. You'll notice it's an oily, waxy substance. And I'm going to ask you a question. What is oil famous for when it's on water?
Floating.
Yeah, exactly right. So oil In water, famous for floating. What are sperm whales famous for doing?
Diving.
Yeah. So this is a bit of a problem. How could they possibly dive with this huge amount of wax and oil in their nose, which is obviously going to make them buoyant? Well, here's something amazing they can do. Is when they're diving, they breathe in seawater through their nostrils, and this actually goes into the spermaceti, causing it to cool, so it constricts and will match the density of the water around it. So they can actually control their buoyancy by using their spermaceti as well. So not only is it a sensory organ, it can also be used as a weapon when hunting prey, but also it can be used to regulate their buoyancy. One last thing I want to see if I can probe you on, see if you guys can put these pieces together. Do you know how sperm whales sleep?
Oh, do they float vertical in the water?
Yes. And what's at the top?
The head, the tip of the head.
Yeah, so why might that be?
It's more buoyant than the rest of the body.
Yeah, it's full of oil. It's buoyant. So it's probably the easiest way for them to rest. Another strange thing about that is they have an exceptionally complicated blowhole, which actually goes through their spermaceti right in the front of their head. And another thing linked to this is some scientists believe that this is because the spermaceti is creating this buoyancy. So when they're sleeping, they tend to sleep, 7 hours a day. And when they're sleeping, this keeps them buoyant and it could keep their blowhole above water because their blowhole is at the very top of their head.
Cool.
So yeah, so this is an amazing organ, the spermaceti from the sperm whale, which is where it gets its name, which can, yeah, do a multitude of things that I'd never even considered.
Wow, thank you for that. That's so interesting. Yeah, I didn't. I knew maybe one or two of those functions, but I didn't realize it was so versatile.
Super cool. I love whales. Every year, I feel like I learn something super cool new about whales. It's like, what are they doing out there?
Hunting giant
squid with their noses.
Yeah.
No longer filling our lamps with oil. Thank goodness. Yeah, that wraps up our conversation this week on organs. I hope you all enjoyed. We're going to come back next week. We'll be back with you on Tuesday with a discussion about memory, if we can remember. Thanks for tuning in. That's a goodbye from us.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Bird brought back the brown. Wait. Sorry. Brilliant. Bird brought back. No.